Good morning, Oregon, and thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, bringing you another daily episode of the Offbeat Oregon History Audio Edition podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. You'll find the full details at our anchor page, which is, I almost said wanker page, that would have been awesome. And our anchor page, which is located at offbeatoregon.com. Check it out. But first, sit back and relax and let me tell you the story of the last big train robbery, which took place on the border between Oregon and California in 1923. Really, really late, not even 100 years ago. This is a really interesting story to me because there are so many repetitions of the number 13. A trio of tragically incompetent brothers by the name of Deo Tremont destroyed a mail car, killed several people, and it was just a bungled attempt at a heist. It was pretty much an unlucky day for everybody involved. Here we go. One of the most dramatic events in Oregon state history took place on October 11, 1923, in a railroad tunnel in southern Oregon. It almost sounds like a Hollywood movie script. The train was the number 13 Gold Special, heading from Seattle to San Francisco. In command was engineer Sidney Bates. It was to be his last run. He was ready to retire and start drawing a nice pension. And at the fateful hour, the train was just cresting the Siskiyou summit and testing its brakes, getting ready to go through tunnel number 13. When the train slowed down to test the brakes, three men jumped aboard. These were the Deo Tremont brothers, 23-year-old twins Ray and Roy, and their teenage brother Hugh. They'd been planning a train robbery for months. They'd heard of the rumor that $500,000 worth of gold was aboard, so train 13 seemed like a good one to hit. They'd stolen some dynamite from a construction site, and of course they were armed with the usual pistols. These they pointed at Bates and ordered him to stop. Bates complied, stopping the train at the end of tunnel 13. Back in the train, the passengers were not pleased. Coal smoke was starting to leak into the cars. Remember, the cars were still inside of the tunnel. Up front, the brothers weren't happy either. The mail clerk, who was actually covering someone else's shift, had barricaded himself inside the car so the brothers couldn't get in. No problem, right? The brothers packed their dynamite around the car and touched it off. Unfortunately for everyone involved, they had no idea what they were doing. They apparently had never handled dynamite before. The amount of dynamite they used was enough to utterly destroy the car, killing the clerk instantly and spreading mail all over the place, and essentially ruining their project for them. Meanwhile, passengers and crew members were trying to fight their way through the smoke and fire to the south end of the tunnel, but the heat was too intense. Finally, a brakeman, Coyle Johnson, managed to fight his way through and was promptly gunned down by the robbers. Likely realizing time was running out and there was no sign of money or gold, the brothers decided to get away while they could. So they killed Engineer Bates and the fireman, Marvin Singh, who were the only witnesses who had seen them, and then they dipped their feet in creosote to throw the bloodhounds off the scent and fled. They might have gotten away with this crime too, except for Edward O. Heinrich, a detective brought in to work in the crime. Heinrich, looking over a pair of overalls left by the bandits, deduced from pitch stains on the garments that the wearer was likely a lumberjack, and from the wear patterns on the buttons that he was left-handed. But the most damning thing he found was a crumpled-up old mail receipt in one of the pockets. He was able to track this right back to the brothers. So, 10 days after the crime, still hiding out in the hills, Ray felt that enough time had passed that he might hop a freight train to Ashland to do some shopping, and once he got there, he opened up a newspaper over a cup of coffee in a diner and saw his name in a headline. Of course, he raced right back to the hideout to tell the others that the beans had been spilled. The brothers, of course, left the area immediately, assuming new identities and starting new lives, which probably would have worked okay too, except that one of the brothers decided his new life was going to involve the U.S. Army. When Hugh joined the army, he was fingerprinted, and somebody noticed that there was a little match there, and the jig was up. All three of the boys drew life sentences. Hugh was paroled in 1959, died a few months later. Roy, who had been given a lobotomy in prison, also died a few months after his parole in 1983. Ray, paroled in 1961, actually died in 1984, and spent many years working as a part-time janitor at the University of Oregon. In fact, there's a really interesting personal essay by the Reverend Marilyn Riedel, I hope I pronounced that name right, and M. Constance Guardino in their Maricon website, which gives a personal account of one of the two of them having met Ray Dotremont during the 1970s when he was working at the University of Oregon. When he was clearly a considerably changed fellow, she was really startled to learn that he was actually a murderer. If you'd like to find that essay and read it, just type Maricon, M-A-R-A-C-O-N, and Dotremont, D'Autremont, into your Google search window. It should take you right to it. It's headlined History Onyx 6. It'll come up on your Google search window under the title Murder on the Gold Special, probably in the top spot. One other thing, and it's a really minor item, but as I was building my website for this stuff, I lined all of these articles up by date of publication and gave them each a number according to where they were in the list of stuff that I had published, you know, from 1 week to the next. And guess what number this story, just by sheer random chance, acquired? That's right. It's number 13. Well, that's it for today's episode. And if you're listening for the first time and would like some more information about Offbeat Oregon history, you can get everything at our central website at offbeatoregon.com. It's the complete catalog of about 195 columns going back to 2008, plus links out to audio and text feeds on RSS, also iTunes, and to the Facebook page and Twitter feed if you'd like to join the conversation. The website's also where you'll find the full citations to sources for this story, which include works by Lawrence Joers, Bill Sullivan, the Maricon website, and the Tunnel13.com website. Our theme music is a track titled Old Man's Waltz by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, written by Carmen Ficarra. Coming to Corvallis, drop me a line. Let's grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at Finn at offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, at offbeatoregon. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons CC by SA license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/CC. And that is it for today. Coming up tomorrow, I'm going to have a Central Oregon mystery for you. I guess it's a mystery. Is that what you'd call it? More like a Central Oregon scavenger hunt. There is a legend of a crystal cave, a cave just lined with crystals all over it that you can go inside of in a rainstorm for shelter somewhere in Central Oregon. Well, it's out there. And somebody knows. He actually gave me a phone call at one point to ask if, you know, to just checking to see if I knew where it was. When he found out I didn't, he sounded a little bit relieved. And when I asked him where it was, he just kind of chuckled. So I'll tell you about the Crystal Cave tomorrow. Look for that after about 6 a.m. In the meantime, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.